Now, how did a collective of self-taught internet sleuths end up solving some of the biggest crimes of our time? Well, I can answer that because we've got the man who started it all, Elliot Higgins, to discuss We Are Bellingcat, a new book about this extraordinary thing that he put together. Morning, welcome to the show, Elliot.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, no problem at all. This is a great story. Let's kind of look at your background first, because the background that you had really has got nothing to do with what you ended up doing.
That's right. Back in 2011, I was working in various admin and finance jobs, and I got very interested in what was happening in the conflict in Libya, and especially kind of online discussions about videos and other content coming from the conflict, and the question of how can we trust any of this content. So I started using satellite imagery and other information to figure out exactly where videos from the conflict were being filmed, and it really all just started from there.
How extraordinary. So it's fair to say that your background wasn't in investigative journalism, but you were a man who liked to look on the internet and try and solve problems effectively and look at stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I was always interested in kind of world events and spending a lot of time online, basically.
Yeah.
And it was just such a big point of discussion. And there seemed all this interesting content that was being shared from people on the ground in Libya that I just wanted to see if we could actually use this to understand what was happening. And this really launched everything. And a few years later, after blogging for a while about Syria and other topics, I launched Bellingcat.
Amazing. And is it true that you responded to a post on YouTube about a Buk missile launcher trundling down a street, and they basically said that who geolocated where the actual missile launcher was gets a gold star sticker?
Yeah, so we have a big community that follows me and Bellingcat on Twitter. And when MH17 was shot down in eastern Ukraine in 2014, just a few days after Bellingcat was launched, there was a lot of video footage of missile launchers and other information from Ukraine. People wanted to see if they could kind of figure out stuff about. And we started looking at these videos and photographs as a community and figured out exactly where they were filmed and photographed. And because we had that, we also had the shadows in these images. And we used those as kind of a sundial to figure out when they were taken. So we were able to use that information to establish the route of this missile launcher through separatist held territory in eastern Ukraine just before MH17 was shot down.
Amazing. And rather interesting, because my next guest at 11:30 has just written a book about the shooting down is what she says it is, of MH370, which was the other Malaysian Airlines flight, which, of course, as we know, disappeared and has never been seen since. And she reckons that was shot down.
I mean, it's very hard to know if MH370. No, I mean, I'm not familiar with her book and her research, but the difficulty with MH370 compared to MH17 was that it disappeared in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
So with MH17, you had lots of people on the ground who were reporting what was happening. So because there was that kind of, I guess, digital impact in the digital world of the event, we could track that back and figure out exactly what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll find out from her at 11:30. So Bellingcat, strange name. Any particular reason for the name?
Yeah, it's actually based off an old fable about a group of mice who were very scared of a large, ferocious cat, and they came up with this idea of putting a bell around the cat's neck. But of course, being mice, they didn't really have a plan to do it, so we're teaching people how to bell the cat.
That's fantastic. I love it. And you keep saying we, so who else is involved in this?
So Bellingcat started off as basically me and a small group of volunteers, and now we're a kind of fully registered charity in the Netherlands with 20 staff members. And we also have a really big community around us of volunteers, and this kind of network we have of just people who are just really interested in finding out the truth about these kind of videos and events and things that are happening. So often our research is crowdsourcing information from people, analyzing it, and kind of building up this just big network of people who are just really dedicated to finding the truth about these events.
So effectively, you couldn't do this 20 years ago because that kind of information just wasn't out there.
Yeah, you wouldn't have the online communities. You wouldn't have kind of the stuff that's being shared on social media thanks to the rise of smartphone technology. And you wouldn't have access to things like satellite imagery like you can get on Google Earth and Google Maps nowadays. So all of those in combination has allowed this kind of new way of researching stuff to be possible.
I know it to a lesser extent because, of course, every guest that I get on, I need to research them. So the internet has proven to be a lovely source. But, of course, the problem is that sometimes you find stuff and you're not sure whether it's real or whether it isn't real. How do you kind of put your filters on stuff?
So when we're looking at stuff, for example, say a photograph that's been taken of a missile launcher in eastern Ukraine, first of all, you have the information, the visual information in the photograph. You might have shop signs or road signs or even distinct buildings. And then you look up something like satellite imagery of the area or Google Street View imagery of the area. Or as in the case of MH17, we had someone driving around with their camera on in their car recording the road. So by looking at all those separate sources, we then use that to confirm the location. And then you're looking at confirming something like when the photograph was taken. And sometimes people could have been posting on social media, oh, I've just seen a missile launcher drive down the road, which in the case of MH17, they actually did on several occasions. So you start building up this kind of network of kind of cross-referencing points until you can be certain that something actually happened at the time it was claimed to have happened, at the place it was claimed to have happened.
So you become quite good then at spotting fake news, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, we deal a lot with stuff that's related to Russia, and the Russian Federation are not fans of Bellingcat, and they partly because we often like reveal that they're lying about stuff. I mean, they've faked evidence in relation to MH17. You know, they've lied a lot about things like chemical weapons attacks in Syria, for example. We've just done a big piece of research investigating the FSB kill team that was behind the Navalny poisoning. And, you know, they immediately responded by saying that we're working for the Western intelligence services and everything we're producing is fake. So, you know, we not only kind of verify stuff in our own work, but we're often a target of misinformation from states like the Russian Federation.
Yes. So once you have your answer, what do you then do with it? Do you take it to authorities or do you simply publish it on your blogs and stuff?
Well, we kind of have this process we call identify, verify, and amplify. So we identify stuff, we verify it, and we turn it into analysis. And that final amplification step, once we have all the verified information, can be a range of things. It can be a typical news article. We've done podcasts, documentaries. But also, because we are dealing with evidence, we often get asked to submit information to court processes, you know, especially around Syria and MH17. So we treat it as evidence, but we can have kind of multiple outcomes from its use. You know, from kind of the legal side to the more kind of journalistic side.
I'm fascinated how you avoid the tag of conspiracy theorist, because effectively what you're doing is not massively miles away from what, for example, David Icke would have done. Say, you know, and I've interviewed David many times. He would postulate a theory. He'd talk about it over the years. He'd put it out there and people would either take notice of it or call him a nutter. Do you get a similar issue with stuff that you put out there?
I mean, usually those kind of statements are coming from, you know, the Russians and their supporters. But what we're using is, because it's open source evidence, we can kind of point to it, like, say, a video or a photograph.
Right.
And then we show, here's the kind of material we've used to verify it. We're very transparent about our process, and we take people through it step by step. And I think because, like with MH17, we kind of made all these discoveries, and then the official police investigation gave a press conference 2 years later where they just agreed with pretty much everything we had said. That kind of helps us build this kind of sense of authority among kind of journalists and researchers and, you know, people who kind of use this material. And because our material ends up being, you know, is intended often to be, you know, potentially used in court, unlike the material of David Icke, we have to, you know, we are putting ourselves in a position where we can be challenged by, you know, lawyers. We can be challenged in court about what we're doing. So we have to be very precise and careful.
Interesting. You talked about the Russians a lot, and there's a particular case which, of course, ignited great interest in the public. There was a documentary on TV many times, and this was about the Sergei Skripal story. And I remember interviewing a journalist about it at the time. And these two characters who allegedly had come to see the Salisbury Cathedral spire, Alexander Petrov and Ruslan Boshirov, you weeded their identities out, right?
Yes. So when they were kind of their identity was kind of first published by the UK authorities, a lot of kind of media across the world were looking into them. And one of the first things that came out were the leaked space leak a passenger manifest of the flight they were on, which included their passport numbers, which were, funnily enough, just a few numbers apart. So we decided to start looking into them. And what you have in Russia is there's a vast amount of leaked information online, Russian databases of travel and other information, plus data brokers. Because Russia is a police state that's also incredibly corrupt, you have people who are selling access to things like passport files and stuff like that. So we would never normally do this, but because it was such an extreme case of a nerve agent assassination basically on British soil, we got some of this information, including their, first of all, the documents of their passport registrations. And they were very odd because they missed key information about their previous passport files, which all Russian passport files should have. They had a stamp on with the phone number of the Russian Ministry of Defense. And they had all this other stuff that indicated there was something very shady about these people.
Right.
And eventually we managed to piece together their real identities. And there were two serving GRU officers. And this was based off all this leaked information coming from the Russian state itself.
Wow. And frankly, having seen the spire of a soldier cathedral, it's not actually worth going to see, to be honest. It's a spire, isn't it?
I'm sure they've got those in Russia. Yeah.
Exactly right. What about these days where we're obviously in the middle of this pandemic and there's a lot of talk of people who are posting stuff which allegedly is anti-government policy. So there's this expression, for example, of anti-vaxxers, which has grown up. And you've got people like Facebook and Twitter who are censoring stuff at source. Now, that's not good news, is it?
It's a really difficult issue because I think the social media companies do have a role in basically what's the kind of building these kind of conspiracy communities in the first place. These, I mean, it's not just anti-vaxxers, it's all kinds of different subjects.
Yeah.
I mean, we deal a lot with people who think Ukraine shot down MH17 or that there's no chemical attacks in Syria. But it's also communities like the QAnon community and the flat earth kind of believers.
Goodness me.
because of social media algorithms, people, if you click on Earth About the Flat Earth, you'll start being recommended stuff about the flat earth. Now, you and I know that the earth is not flat, but
Absolutely.
Some people might be susceptible to that. And then they click on more links and they get drawn into these kind of online communities that are filled with people who have spent years working on these subjects. And it's the same with all these other topics. So over time, they start finding themselves surrounded by people who are saying, yes, you're right, the earth is flat, or you're right that, you know, Bill Gates is putting microchips in the vaccine, or, you know, those kind of theories.
Mm.
And they see themselves as in opposition to the liars, which are the mainstream media, mainstream doctors, mainstream scientists who say the earth is round.
Yep.
And they see themselves as the heroes, the truth seekers. And I think social media companies bear a certain degree of responsibility for this. And this may be an overcorrection because they've allowed these groups to form by recommending them, saying, oh, you might be interested in following these people who think the earth is flat.
Mm.
And over time, these groups become, in a way, detached from reality. And it's very hard to reach those people because if you're saying, oh, you know, I've done a fact check, they're saying, well, you're just part of the conspiracy against us. And this fact check is wrong because I have 20 people saying that, you know, the earth really is flat, or, you know, QAnon is real.
Mm.
So it becomes a real problem, I think, for society. And often these issues are seen as, you know, outside influence, you know, attacking society through disinformation campaigns like Russia, for example, around various topics. But often it's really pre-existing communities that are propagating and spreading this information.
Here's my problem with fact checkers. Okay, who are they? Who appointed them experts? Who appointed them the gurus of facts? Where have these people sprung from suddenly that they're such experts at everything?
I think the key thing when you're fact checking is, you know, one thing that's useful about kind of open source evidence is you can be very transparent about where all your sourcing is coming from. Be very detailed and go through things step by step. I think my problem with fact checkers is often people aren't really interested in fact checking as a thing by itself. For our work, we are fact checking, but it's part of larger stories and it's part of kind of evidence gathering and kind of showing what happened. When you just say, oh, here's a website that has fact checked this one thing, 100 people will read it. And what impact does that actually have? And I think often, you know, I do a lot of work, you know, talking to policymakers about these issues. And often they're just so focused on, oh, we need to have lots of fact checking websites. They aren't really thinking about building communities online that are kind kind of, you know, really dedicated to, you know, doing kind of what Bellingcat is doing, building these communities who work together, they look at stuff and they learn to understand things.
I often think, and I've interviewed somebody in great detail about Galileo, and if Galileo hadn't been so kind of brave and constant in his beliefs, we would still, for hundreds of years, probably have thought that the sun revolved around the Earth, as did the rest of the planets. In fact, he was locked away by the church for his theories. Sometimes people who have these outlandish thoughts are actually right. But I guess what you're saying is now we can actually check because you can verify the sources. So that's something Galileo didn't have the luxury of, I guess.
Yeah, and because we do have access to this vast amount of information and we can look at something and see it from multiple perspectives. I mean, it's like, for example, I can get a video from Syria showing an airstrike. And you might say, well, how do you know where that's filmed? Well, we do this process of geolocation using satellite imagery to cross-reference it. And then people might say, well, how do you know this building was blown up this week? You get satellite images from the day before, the day after, and you right. show that the building's there on one. So you have all these different ways to actually go down and check this kind of thing. I mean, still, you do get kind of issues. I mean, one thing I'm seeing a lot with the January 6th Washington, D.C. Events, of the violence on the ground, are communities appearing on social media and elsewhere trying to identify people. And you have this kind of groupthink happening where you get someone who says, oh, I think it's this person, and people start agreeing. And then 3 weeks later, when this person has been, you know, harassed out of their mind, it turns out it's a completely different person. So often when we're doing our work and we're kind of crowdsourcing stuff, we're asking questions of our community. It's quite simple, like, do you know where this place is? Do you know where this object is? Has anyone seen more videos of this thing? Not who is this person? Because when you ask people to do these complicated investigations, you end up having this kind of groupthink occurring. And it kind of has a parallel with these kind of other communities I'm talking about, the kind of more conspiracy minded communities, where you have that same kind of groupthink happening. So even people who are seeking the truth can still be vulnerable as a kind of online community to, you know, believing misinformation, even if they have a genuine, you know, belief that they're trying to find the correct information and the truth.
Were you involved in any way in looking into Donald Trump while he was in power? You know, he made some extraordinary claims right up until the fact that the election was rigged and the postal votes were rigged. Is that something that you guys would have looked into, or did you leave him well alone?
Well, I mean, really with that, there were so many people kind of focusing on that subject. I mean, with Bellingcat, we're always trying to do stuff that other people aren't looking at. Right. And with Donald Trump, I mean, we had people fact-checking every single word he said and, you know, finding thousands and thousands of lies. We were kind of more interested in the communities that rose around Donald Trump. So stuff like the QAnon communities and the kind of far-right communities who were kind of turning up at like the Unite the Right rally at Charlottesville. And we helped identify some of the people involved with the violence there. So we never really want to do stuff that other people are already doing, because we're a small organization and there's huge kind of, you know, New York Times and Washington Post looking into what Donald Trump is saying, and, you know, they've got more of a budget than we do and more time to do it.
And so if people want to find out more about what you do, I'm assuming you have a website that has all of this stuff on it.
Yeah, so bellingcat.com, it has our articles. It also has resources for people who want to learn how to do it as well. They can follow us on social media at bellingcat.com, where we share other information. We even share like a toolbox with all the tools that we're using so people can get involved themselves. And we're hoping to launch later in this year a volunteer section. So if you want to get involved, you can actually see, you know, what we need help with and, you know, have a go at doing it yourself.
Amazing. Is there any danger in what you're doing? I mean, you're poking the hornet's nest a lot of the time, and some of those hornets are pretty scary. Is that something that worries you?
Well, I mean, we do have to be very careful. I mean, it really started back in 2014 when we were doing work on MH17, where we had a lot of the kind of Russian state media attacking our work and making accusations against us of, you know, either being amateurs or working for the CIA or MI5 or whatever three-letter agency was in their mind at the time. Yeah. Russian officials started saying that stuff. And then we started finding our emails were being targeted by hackers, and that was linked back to the Russian federation by three separate cybersecurity companies. We then started having more and more allegations after the Skripal investigation that we were working for the intelligence agencies. And, you know, I've been personally spoken to by the UK police about my personal safety. My colleagues who work in other parts of the world, they've also had, you know, the police talk to them because, you know, once you start exposing Russian assassins, you know, like we've been doing, sure, it does put you on their kind of target list.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, more power to you, sir. Good for you. The book, if people want to have a look at it, it's called We Are Bellingcat, an intelligence agency for the people. And you can get that book from our website, tre.radio. And as you've mentioned there, you can go and look at your own website as well. Fantastic to talk to you today. As they say in the movies, keep up the good work, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
All the best. Thank you, Alec. Cheers. Take care.